Hello, this is Donna Seaman welcoming you to Open Books, an hour of conversation about outstanding books, remarkable writers, and the fine art of reading. We're honored to have as our guest a great American fiction writer, Russell Banks, the author of many works, including Continental Drift, Rule of the Bone, Affliction, and The Sweet Hereafter, which have both been made into exceptionally fine films, and the much-acclaimed novel Cloud Splitter. Russell Banks' numerous awards include a Guggenheim Fellowship, a National Endowment for the Arts Fellowship, the John Dos Passos Award, and the Literature Award from the American Academy of Arts and Letters. Russell Banks' new book is titled The Darling. Welcome.
Thanks, Donna.
In looking at your work as a whole, a reader can trace an evolution from probing fiction about individuals and families and private matters to works that encompass larger concerns, matters of class and race, violence and freedom. Was this in any way a conscious development?
I don't think so. I think like most younger writers, I probably was drawing, you know, most immediately on my own experiences and memories and so forth growing up. And that my world gradually began to expand, and as my world expanded, then I guess the material that was available to me and that was interesting and important to me also expanded. I mean, I could have kept drawing on my own personal and private and family experiences to write about, but I think I would have ended up bored very quickly, and so I just followed what I was interested in, and so it's a natural kind of evolution, I guess. Nothing that conscious or deliberate and nothing programmatic, for sure.
That's interesting. I'm sure there's an element of confidence that develops, too, as you're writing. And
well, yes and no. I mean, what happens, I think, with most young writers, certainly it's what happened with me, is that it takes a while to map out the nature of your own, or the terrain, really, of your own imagination. Because we all have differently shaped imaginations, and what's mysterious to one person is completely obvious to another, and vice versa, you know. So you spend a number of years, I think, trying to find out what it is that's truly mysterious to you and what's known already to you. And that can be, for some, a very long and elaborate process, as it was for me. And that's why you try different modes, you try different kinds of writing, you fall in love with different writers. Gradually, though, you begin to realize what it is that is truly important to you, and as I say, mysterious to you, and that's where you're going to engage your imagination. And so it isn't quite confidence, it's just self-knowledge, I think, perhaps more than anything else. And you also do become a little more skillful in certain areas and competent, and you know that, you recognize your own level of competence. You can't take the measure of your work really in any, you know, definitive sense, but subjectively you can make certain judgments, and that helps too, because you don't have to go down all the way down the line to find out that it's the wrong line. You know, you don't
right.
That it's just a cul-de-sac, and you can tell almost instantly that this is not going to interest me. This is not going to engage me. I don't have to write 150 pages to find that out, or 300 pages to find that out.
Right. Good point. I look at your novel Cloud Splitter as mm-hmm. kind of a big step, I guess. You worked for a long time on it. Mm-hmm. It's a historical novel mm-hmm. About John Brown and mm-hmm. the abolitionist movement. Mm-hmm. And then we get The Darling, mm-hmm. set in Liberia. Now, I don't know how many people remember the connection between the slavery in the United States mm-hmm. and this African country. Did the story of John Brown lead you to Liberia?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yes. Also, not only do most people not remember that there is such a connection, those who do remember that there is a connection tend to see that connection as being benevolent and benign, which it was not. It was a cruel and complex one. But I did come to the history of Liberia, the formation and creation of Liberia and its evolution over the 19th century, certainly, in researching Cloud Splitter, in doing research on the early years of the anti-slavery movement, because Liberia is a creation of something called the American Colonization Society, which really was about solving, as they saw it at that time, in a feel-good way, the growing race problem on the streets of Philadelphia, New York, and Boston, and other northern cities, because of the increasing numbers of freed ex-slaves, and who were building societies, you know, building churches and schools and businesses and whatnot, and were giving the lie to the racist argument that these people were somehow less than human. They were also bad examples to the slaves south of Mason-Dixon as well. So, and they were activists, many of them. So it was a feel-good way to solve that problem. They could say, well, we're really sending them back to Africa, and we're Christianizing, and we're civilizing, and making it safe for capitalization, for capitalism, this savage land. So they essentially set down, about 70,000, I think, went from the United States, a whole surrogate colony, basically, is what happened. But they set down a class of people on top of 16 ethnic groups that were already living there, the native people who were already living there. Allowed them to set up a society which was an oppressive one, more or less modeled on the society that they had left in the United States. And they established this Americo-Liberian class. They called themselves the Americos, which was a ruling class, and operated really for the next 150 years in Africa as a surrogate colony. So when things blew up there in the 1980s and the Civil War erupted in the 90s, after the United States essentially pulled out because the Cold War was over and we didn't need Liberia anymore, we didn't need a base in Africa as we saw it, and foreign aid dried up, and the class of people that we had propped up, the ruling class that we had propped up all these years, were no longer propped up. I understood what was happening and why, and that it had roots in it that went right back to the story of race in the United States, which is the story I was most interested in. I mean, I didn't just want to write about Africa.
Right.
You know,
right.
I wanted to write about the story of race in my own culture and country and history. And so, but this was, to me, an important chapter, you know.
It's an amazing story. I really... as I was reading The Darling, I had remembered reading about Liberia. And, of course, you know, the Monrovias, mm-hmm. their capital. I mean, they speak English. Mm-hmm. The people are named after, you know, have mm-hmm. what we consider American mm-hmm. names or Anglo names. And it had, you know, that you make this point that there was this indigenous population mm-hmm. of Africans and that, yeah. you know, African Americans went over there. And you have a really strong line in the book. You write about how these freed slaves just recreated the mm-hmm. plantation system, and you say, no reason for the whip hand not to be to be black. No
That's
reason
right.
not to be black. Which reminded me of Edward P. Jones' novels, The Known
mm-hmm.
World,
oh, yeah, right.
about black
yeah.
slave
right.
owners. Right. So you sort of immediately set up, and you set up the situation when you bring us to Liberia to understand that there's race, but there's also class,
mm-hmm.
and there's greed and corruption and political meddling that mm-hmm. you know is sort of beside the point of race. So
I suppose in some sense it's a way of universalizing human
yes,
nature.
Exactly.
I mean, you know, we're all just as evil, no matter the color of our skin, in some ways. But I just wanted to contextualize. In a complex, yet I hope realistic way, and plausible way, the drama that this woman, the narrator of the novel, Hannah Musgrave, who's a white American radical of the 60s and 70s, her political drama, racially, in terms of class and so forth, and personally and privately, familially, could be dramatized, I thought, in this context, you see.
That's such interesting parallel. Let's back up and talk a little bit about Hannah. She comes from a very liberal household. Her father's mm-hmm. like a Dr. Spock sort of mm-hmm. child specialist, and she has to kind of out-liberal him, mm-hmm. it seems. She starts out doing good works. She goes to the South, registers black voters, mm-hmm. then gets involved with the Weathermen,
yeah.
Ends up underground,
mm-hmm.
Flees the country, ends up in Africa. So we end up in the novel kind of being encouraged to parallel the radical movements, mm-hmm. the civil rights movement in the United States with Liberia.
Mm-hmm.
How did that connection come? This is like 100 years apart, really,
yeah.
the Civil War to the civil rights movement.
Well, one of the things that I've always been interested in is sort of unintended consequences.
Yes,
and also the unintended consequences of idealism, really. I mean, of principled lives, and what often is the case, the harm that it causes as well. Unexamined life, you know, causes a lot of harm in many ways, and even if it's an idealistic life and a principled life. And Hannah's is classic in that way, because it does parallel, though, you know, the early settlement of Liberia, because it was thought to be a part of the anti-slavery movement and meant to be that. At one point, even Abraham Lincoln supported it early on in his career. Most of the African-American intellectuals of that era saw through it.
Yes.
Frederick Douglass saw through it instantly and tried to discourage anyone from participating in it. But because it was so intimately linked to Christianity as well, and these were Christian ministers who were promoting it by and large, although there were a lot of lawyers and others as well. Among them, Francis Scott Key was one of the early supporters,
right?
And organizers and funders of it, yeah. But it was a well-intended project. I mean, that's at least as conscious as they could get, just as in some sense you could rationalize the colonial effort, too,
yeah.
I mean, and did. You know, we're bringing Christianity and civilization to this dark continent and saving these people from themselves. And so, in some sense, you know, radical politics have a similar impulse, and it often does lead, as I think happened in Weatherman, to unintended consequences, and what I was really interested in, though, on a sort of psychological level, and I suppose a historical level too, given, you know, history of my own lifetime, of the last 35 or 40 years, my own adult life, was really who were these people. And especially the women in the movement, in the radical end of the movement.
Why especially the women?
Well, I knew the men better, because I was along, you know, the line myself. I mean, I went from the civil rights movement to the anti-war movement to SDS, the Students for Democratic Society. I didn't follow it all the way out to Weatherman, but I certainly knew a lot of people who did, and most of the people I knew were men. And of course, most of the people who got a lot of press and got the memoirs and so forth,
yeah,
were men. And
right.
And yet I knew, and certainly as I got older, I realized that there were a lot of the foot soldiers were women, and a lot of the work was done by women on every level. They weren't just, you know, they just weren't as visible as the men. And so I wanted to know who were they, and I also wanted to know, where are they now?
Mm-hmm.
As I, you know, hit 60, I'm sure they were hitting 60, and looking back on their youth and those years in their lives, just as I was, and that was the third thing I guess I wanted to know, was what do they think about where they were then, you know, and now that we are, you know, after 2000, after 9/11, 2001, when you look through that prism back at those years and those actions of you know, violent actions, radical attacks on the state, on property, you know, using means that today would be called terrorist.
Yes.
And how does that look now? So that was an impulse as well. And I guess there was a third zone of interest for me too, besides Liberia and besides this particular aspect of radical politics, and that was, it's a little harder for me to explain really, is where it comes from, and that's chimpanzees.
Yes.
You know, and that ends up being a kind of third subject, I guess, in the novel that the character of Hannah Musgrave draws together.
Well, before we get to the chimps, Hannah's such a complicated character. I mean, she's very detached.
Mm-hmm.
She's tough. She's mm-hmm. smart, but you know, she has no gift for intimacy with human
mm-hmm.
beings.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's right.
You and she has a lifelong issue with her parents, which
mm-hmm.
is very wrenching, really.
Mm-hmm.
That's recreated through letters in the novel, mm-hmm. The Darling. She's no darling.
No.
Throughout the book, I kept thinking mm-hmm. she's daring. Mm-hmm. She's, you know, admirable in certain ways. You know, besides the chimps, because that's where she's redeemed, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder, as a writer, as a male writer in particular, mm-hmm. How did you get her voice? How did you determine this sort of psychologically And damaged in some ways.
Personally. Yes, but not. I don't think of her as damaged quite. Neurotic, certainly. Yes. Yeah, yeah. But you know, who isn't? But the ways in which she was neurotic really interested me, and I did not think women are generally portrayed as neurotic in this particular way. Men often are.
Yes, you know,
men
right.
are often portrayed as sort of like. Somewhat distant, cool, detached, committed to a program and sacrificing relationships in order to pursue that program.
Exactly.
In fact, I've had a couple of journalists, as I've been out here on the hustings, address it, and it's mainly men who address the character of Hannah, and they say, you know, I don't know whether I'm supposed to like her or not, or put her down. You know, how am I supposed to feel towards her? And they're obviously confused, and they're also slightly irritated with me because I haven't told them how they're supposed to feel towards
right.
her. And so I've pointed out a couple of times now to them that that if she were a woman, let's say she were a man, not a woman, and a man could do everything that she does with the exception of giving birth, but a man could be the father
sure.
of three sons with an African wife who was a minister and a minor minister in the government of Liberia and so forth. It happens. Everything she does could be done by a man. And if he were telling his story, I think you would see him as a kind of stoical, Hemingway-esque, existential hero, maybe more a Graham Greene type hero, in search for meaning in a meaningless world, in search for morality in an amoral world. And you would find his inability to find meaningfulness and morality as a kind of tragic thing. But because he's a woman, you're having a problem. And you're so used to having female characters in film and in novels and so forth presented, I think, either in an idealized way or in a dismissive way, you know, put down.
Exactly.
Especially if it's a woman whose author or creator is a man.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're disturbed by this in some way. And
well, it's interesting because, I mean, you really do kind of rile the reader. I mean, it's, you know, as a woman reader,
yeah.
I accepted her completely, but
yeah.
I also, you know, understood because this, you've given us her confession.
Mm-hmm.
And she's telling us, mm-hmm. as she's telling the story, that she knows she made mistakes
yeah.
and that she has regrets. But, you know, also it was a matter of survival for her,
mm-hmm.
which you understand. But you give her, you know, you sort of play with her femininity. Mm-hmm. When she's a little girl, she wants to be called Scout.
Yeah.
And she
yeah.
is a stoic always as
yeah.
a kid, an only child and a difficult marriage,
mm-hmm.
Or her parents, and she has women lovers, and
mm-hmm.
she's, you know, she sort of remains untrappable. I mean,
yeah.
that's part of her personality.
Yeah, and she's one of those women, or I should say, female children, which is not uncommon, that identify with across genders, identify with
their
father
body.
Rather than with their mother,
sure.
and that's part of her problem within the family. In a way, she identifies with the powerful person. He's also the idealistic one, the intellectual one, and so forth. But he's a man,
right?
And he abuses his power, as most men are inclined to do, and exploits the mother in various ways and dominates her and so forth. So she's caught in that little dynamic, and one of her ways of dealing with it is to kind of like bend gender a little bit.
Yeah.
And so she, yeah, when she's an adolescent, she takes this genderless name, Scout, and and she tends to look for genderless identities. And she, and her politics at one point, she says, my politics masculinized me. She takes pride in her mechanical ability,
right.
and that she's good in math and those things like that.
Right, right. And she ends up running a farm.
Yeah,
I mean,
exactly.
She's a very capable.
Oh yeah,
person.
And she sets up that sanctuary, you know, and really,
yeah.
you know, it does it's hard physical work and
right.
logistical, hard logistically.
Well, even her marriage. I mean, the way she ends up in Liberia. So. Mm. We'll work our way to the chimps through really probably my favorite character, which is Woodrow. How do you pronounce it?
Sundiata, yeah.
Sundiata. Now, you had to have fun writing those courtship scenes between this minister of public health in Liberia and
yeah,
Hannah.
And this American, white American radical on the loose, yeah, trying to running from her identities.
And she's starting, she's in her 30s, she's starting to think that it might be nice to just come out, you know,
yeah.
to stop being underground.
Right.
And she finds herself in this politically ambiguous situation in Liberia, and they just sort of recognize each other. They're both people that have a lot of masks and know how to, you know, survive in ambivalent situations.
Right. Well, he comes from a, he's a man who's self-divided, as in some of the same ways that, that she is, self-invented and self-divided. He has this past, which is really, his people, as he refers to them, my people. Well, when he talks about his people, he's talking about tribal people in the bush. He's a missionary schooled boy. I mean, he was plucked out of the family and out of the village, the tiny little village of 12 conical huts, and taken to missionary school and then taken to high school in Monrovia, the city, and then educated in the United States. Abroad at a Christian college, Gordon College in Massachusetts, and then returns and quickly rises, as often is the case in a country like that, rises in the government because he's one of the few members of the educated class now. But he's still a village boy,
Right.
And he's divided in that way, and he can't cross back and forth with ease, and he can't take her to that part of himself.
That's a tremendous scene where they try.
It doesn't really work out very well. But he's like her in some ways, in that for other reasons he has tried to invent himself, but he can't, and he's succeeded in it to an enormous degree, but he can't also lose the self he was in the past. And I think a lot of us do this. It's almost a peculiarly American disease in some ways, or fantasy maybe is a better way to put it. We think we can become another person and go on the road and do it, or change our name and do it, or whatever, and we do it to a considerable degree, yet that old self kind of sticks to you, and you can't really shuck it all together.
That's right, and they really are both stuck in that mode. I mean, even Hannah's so thousands of miles away from home and still...
And then, ironically, she finds herself turning into her mother.
After
they marry, she finds herself becoming this kind of bourgeois housewife, whose all of his biggest tasks are shopping and making lists and organizing the servants and so forth.
That's right.
She realizes, with horror, that she's becoming her mother in this utterly different world. Yeah,
it's so very rich predicaments. But let's talk about the great love of her life, which turns out not to be human beings, but chimpanzees.
Yeah.
I was so curious about this. This is sort of a new dimension in your fiction.
I suppose it is. I got really interested in chimpanzees more or less by accident. I've always been curious about relationship between human beings and other species and that zone where we meet and attempt to communicate with one another. Has always fascinated with me, but I live in upstate New York near the border of Quebec, and across the border, not very far from my home, is a fantastic sanctuary for chimpanzees that have been abused in medical research or in the entertainment industry. The woman up there runs them. So I just visited her and her sanctuary and got to know her and got to know the chimpanzees there, and it really just started to move me so deeply that I started visiting other sanctuaries where they maybe weren't so damaged or traumatized as hers. There was one in Columbus, Ohio, and one down in Georgia. And then I even went to Africa, finally, to Sierra Leone, where there was a fantastic chimpanzee sanctuary in the middle of the rainforest. And they just came to mean a lot to me in a number of different ways. But one of the ways in which it connected to the novel, this was before I really began to write the novel, or that before the character of Hannah Musgrave was clear in my mind. I came to see the women who ran these sanctuaries, and they were always women, sort of like Jane Goodall or Diane Fossey and so forth. We know some of the famous ones, but they're all over the world, in orangutans, and it's with higher primates and gorillas and chimpanzees and bonobos. They're very similar to the women who were in the radical wing of American politics in the 60s and 70s. They're white. They are usually from privileged backgrounds, from idealistic households, families, well-educated, usually with a strong and idealistic, principled, and accomplished father with whom they identify. And they sacrifice a lot of the same things that those women in the movement sacrifice. They sacrifice career, family, They live under sort of, they sacrifice creature comforts, they live under duress, they're often held up to ridicule in many ways, many of the same ways. So when I saw that, I thought, well, yeah, this would be a real interesting way to explore my interest in and curiosity about chimpanzees and the people who dedicate their lives to protecting them, which is a political act when you think about it.
Absolutely.
It isn't necessarily thwarted, you know, as a sexually thwarted, as oftentimes these women are dismissed.
Yeah.
It's a political act, to me, of great nobility. And I could maybe have a character who could follow, or whom I could follow, into all these three areas of my great curiosity, which was, you know, Liberia and the radical underground of the 60s and 70s, and chimpanzees. so that's where Hannah kind of emerged from this.
Yes.
You know.
Yes. Well, I found myself thinking about Goodall and Fosse the woman's name I can't pronounce who works with orangutans.
And they're often thought of as cold and detached, people say, well, they don't understand human beings, but they understand chimpanzees, you know. But that's not necessarily all the story.
The story is
much more complicated than that.
Also, you know, you sort of lead the reader into seeing what's going on in Liberia as sort of a capitalist center where the land and the indigenous people and the animals are all abused for corporate purposes, for profit, for money making. And so you write very powerfully about the destruction of nature in Liberia, and Hannah herself and Woodrow too see this. They understand that this is happening. So that puts us on a whole other level where we're looking at, you know, historically what industrialization has done to nature and, you know, endangered animals. Mm-hmm. And you make the point that chimpanzees are so close to us genetically that actually there's a point where you say that a female chimpanzee would be more closely related to me than you are.
Yeah, it's because that extra Y chromosome and the genes attached to it. But this is not news to you, right? That human males are closer to human to chimpanzee males than they are to human females. Genetically, yeah.
Yeah.
No, we are so close to chimpanzees. We're closer to chimpanzees than the eastern bluebird is to the western bluebird.
It's amazing.
Genetically, yeah.
It's amazing. So, you know, as, for many people who do love animals and understand that our connection with other species is really essential to life, then Hannah's response to the chimpanzees, she finds in this dreadfully dirty, slapdash laboratory in Monrovia, makes instant sense. And the fact that she responds to them is really very moving. And I wonder if at this point in our show you would like to read the passages early in the book where she comes to that. And I will tell our listeners that this is Russell Banks reading from The Darling.
Right. This is a passage, a couple of pages here, where she talks about how she came to call them, as she does. I won't say what she comes calling. It'll come, obviously. She says, let me just see. She says, in the early days, when I first set up the sanctuary, I cared mainly for the babies, newborns, and infants. I had two helpers more experienced with chimps than I. They took care of the older, more demanding, and sometimes dangerous chimps who often arrived at the sanctuary traumatized by abuse and from afar, found stuffed into packing crates at JFK or LAX or in bird cages or cat carriers on their way to an even more abused life and a mercifully early death in a pharmaceutical laboratory in Vienna or New Jersey. To help them, one needed much more experience and knowledge of animals than I had then. So at first I worked in the nursery, as we called it, and from the appearance and actions of the babies in my care, from the quality of their gazes and the intensity of their attention, I thought it was in their nature to dream, even when awake. From the start I tried to penetrate their consciousness, for it was obvious that they possessed consciousness, and to me its particular quality was the same as what the Australian Aborigines meant by dream time. Not drifting or soporifically sliding through life, their attention always askew or elsewhere like ours, but behaving as if they were free to look at every single thing as if it had never been seen before, as if everything, a leaf, an ant, a human ear, were of terrible and wondrous significance, as it is in a dream, or as it must be for someone suffering from dementia. For them it seemed there was no consciousness of past or future, only the immediate present from which nothing could distract them. For us, it's almost the opposite. They are non-human animals imprisoned on the far side of speech, but they share nearly 99% of our genes and more closely resemble humans than a bluebird from the east coast of the United States resembles a bluebird from the west. But because they're mute from birth to death, locked out of spoken language, their powers of concentration appear to exceed ours, except when we dream, when we too are mute. And so I began to call them dreamers. Mornings, when I headed from the house for the lab or later on for the sanctuary, I might say to Woodrow, "I've got a new dreamer coming in today, a baby." They found him in a market in Buchanan with a chain around his neck. At first, Woodrow would smile tolerantly in his usual manner, maybe slightly amused by my, to him, eccentric insistence on referring to them as dreamers. But before long, he too gave up relying on the word chimpanzee or chimp. The boys, even sooner than their father, took to calling them dreamers, especially Dylan, for whom the word seemed to have a special resonance, as if he thought that he himself might be a dreamer. "How are the dreamers today, Mommy? What's happened with the dreamer that came down from Nimba last week, the one whose mother you said got eaten by the soldiers? Why do they even want to eat dreamers, Mommy? You'd have to be kind of crazy, right?" Early on in the work at the lab and later at the sanctuary, before it had become my obsession and in a way my salvation, I wondered where the word chimpanzee had come from. It was a peculiar word, I thought. Whenever I said it aloud, I heard a combination of sounds that were slightly comical to me. Their name was a little bit ridiculous, and thus ridiculing. Once, shortly after I started the sanctuary, I looked the word up in Woodrow's battered old Webster's Collegiate, because I hated calling them that, chimpanzees and chimps. Their name seemed to make subtle fun of them, to diminish and demean them, and was not at all a word like human, or even like the names we give to other mammals putatively lower on the evolutionary ladder than chimps, like dogs and lions and horses. It's a Bantu word from the Congo, meaning mock man, a name derived not from the creature's own nature, but from its relation to us, to humans, as if its essential nature were a lesser version or a negation of ours. It's the only species named in such a purposefully distancing way. It's the not-human, the not-us, the unman. Maybe its scientific name would be better, I thought, more democratic somehow, since chimpanzees and humans belong to the same genus, Anthropopithecus. But no, the zoologists had long ago named the creature Anthropopithecus troglodyte, and every mother's child knows what a troglodyte is. Nonetheless, I looked that word up too, hoping, I suppose, that it would turn out actually to mean something like a highly intelligent and sociable animal found in sharply decreasing numbers in the jungles of West Africa. But a troglodyte is one of various races or tribes of men, chiefly ancient or prehistoric, inhabiting caves or dens. It was circular then, and kept coming back to us, to not us.
Oh, thank you so much, from the darling. That's a really beautiful passage, and the dreamers become Hannah's focus throughout war and sort of temporary exile in the U.S. And later, there's sort of this amazing passage where she returns to thinking about the dreamer's muteness. And she equates speech with violence. And you have her think or write, "If humans, like the rest of animals, could not speak, we would all live together in peace. The power of speech is the speech of power." It's quite a radical thought for a writer.
Yeah, well, it is true. And the abuse of language is a means by which, you know, here we are on election morning,
yes,
by which people are controlled and organized and tricked into voting against their own self-interest, if you want.
Exactly.
But also it's. You know, it alters us. Speech language gives us such extraordinary power. That's unnatural power. I mean, the power of one species over another, and other than human, is fairly natural. You know, we call it the food chain. But it's not to dominate and control and exploit and so forth.
Balance.
Right, exactly. It is a function in the larger universe, the larger world. But speech makes all the difference, that power. it seems. I mean, that's Hannah speaking, of course. It's not me. And there's much that she says I agree with, and much, not much, but many things she says I don't personally share. But and I might not feel take it to that extremity that she does. But it's a way of that she is thinking guiltily, really, about her own power. And it's a kind of romance that she has with the chimpanzees, but and a longing for silence too. I mean, you know, monks take all from all different religions take vows of silence for a reason, and it's a suspicion of language, and especially its ability to deceive and manipulate and control.
Yes, exactly. Mm. Well, and language plays a role, and naming plays a really profound role in the civil war that. Breaks out in Liberia that you cover in the novel. I'm thinking of her sons and what happens with them, that when people enter these bands, these rebel bands, they take warnings.
Right. That's very common actually across the world, but because you change your identity.
Right.
You become a different person. And, of course, there are a lot of rituals associated with that transformation from... you know, especially with child soldiers, because you really do want to change their identity, and their identities are relatively malleable and easily changed, and so they want them to have another name, so other than Dylan and, you know, and so forth.
Right.
They want them to be called Sly and Demonology and Worse Than Death. Those are the three names the boys take. But all and then there's a couple of other passages that talk about other child soldiers who have different names, like their war names, you know.
Right, right. And it is a way to distance them from the reality of what they're experiencing. Mm-hmm. It's in The Darling, you mix historical figures with fictional figures. What was it like fictionalizing Charles Taylor, for instance? And he's a very powerful character in the novel.
Yeah, he is. And I did... I did a lot of reading about him, naturally, going back to when he first starts appearing in print, and then up to more recent accounts, and talked to John Lee Anderson and other writers who had actually interviewed him and knew him to some degree over the years. And so I was, he's a monstrous man. I'm very glad he's a long ways from Liberia right now. He's at house arrest in Nigeria I'm not sure he'll stay there, but at the moment he's out of power and seems to be confined, but he is he was a monster and who started and was very attractive in the early days when he first appeared on the scene. He was educated and charismatic and had a kind of politics that looked like it might work in that. Exploited and downtrodden country, and in fact, I spent some time interviewing a friend of my family's, my wife's family, my father-in-law, a friend who had been the CIA station chief in Monrovia in the 70s during the Tolbert years, and now retired and quite elderly, but happy to talk about those years with me. Since it was just in the family, as it were.
So he thought.
Yeah, and we were all at Skull and Bones together, and that's just not the case. But but anyhow, I asked him about Charles Taylor, who had mysteriously escaped from prison in the United States before he reappeared as a warlord a little bit later. And he said, well, that was after my time, because that was during Samuel Doe's era. And I said, well, yeah, but is it plausible that the CIA could have been involved with getting him out of prison because they saw him as a useful alternative to Samuel Doe, who was going off the deep end at that point? And he said, oh, certainly, it's quite plausible. We were involved. He said, but I don't know the details. So I thought, well, okay, if it's plausible to him, it's got to be plausible to me as a novelist. And I can work that in and work that out, because I was aware of the degree to which the CIA had been involved in establishing the government of Liberia, governments, plural, of Liberia over the years, starting with Tolbert and their support and propping up of before Tolbert, even Tubman, and then Tolbert, and then Samuel Doe was, I think, their man in Africa briefly, and until he turned into a monster and an uncontrollable, and then they thought Charles Taylor might solve the problem, because they operated that way in Congo, they operated that way all the way across Africa, they operated that way in Greece, they operate that way in South America and Latin America, in Central America,
absolutely,
Caribbean. So why are they suddenly going to operate differently in Liberia, where really it's ours anyhow, right? You know, to do with as we wish.
It's just shocking to sort of come back to this. I mean, and it's really the way it's built into the novel, you know, allows the reader to come to it freshly. And so we're reading The Darling, you know, set in the 1970s and 1980s here while we're in a very messy war in Iraq. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I always think of the term the Great Game, which was a 19th mm-hmm. century
right.
term for what the Brits and the French and mm-hmm. us and the Germans have done in that part of the world and continue to do, and realize how ignorant mm-hmm. most of us are about what really goes on in these
mm-hmm.
places.
Mm-hmm.
And here we're setting up leaders again, and, you know, I don't know mm-hmm. who these men are and how beholden to the CIA and to the government.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it
mm-hmm.
remains this, you know, that whole dark side of
yeah, and it's done with, from our side, with a kind of entitlement and set of assumptions that it's for not only for our good, but it's for the good of the world, and it's for the good of the people that we're manipulating and controlling.
Exactly.
Whether we're controlling them through violence or bribery or furtive machinations backstage. It doesn't matter. We're doing it for the good of everybody, just as those early Christians were in setting up Liberia, and just as Hannah herself was doing, you know, in the 60s and 70s and later in her life, when she was liberating, she saw Charles Taylor from prison in the United States. You know, that came from actually the Weatherman actually sprung Timothy Leary from prison.
Yes,
and do you remember this story?
Right,
in north of Northern California, when he was serving a sentence for drug possession and distribution, and they sprung, not only did they spring him, it was a prison very like the one Charles Taylor was in Massachusetts, you know, some of the minimum security prisons, not only did they spring him, they got him all the way to Algeria before anybody knew where he was, and then he had a press conference, and I thought, you know, if they could do that with him, why not, you know?
Really? Well, so it's interesting, there's a you know, embassy, American Sam Clemens in Liberia, that sort of shadows Hannah all the time. And, you know, here's where she appears to be very naive.
Mm,
I mean, her romanticism has interfered with any reasonable judgment.
Yeah.
And she's a pawn as much as everyone else.
She also thinks she's, in a way, too powerful for him to have any real control over, because she's visible, she's white American, she's married to a minister in the government. And so he's just a minor, low-level guy at the ministry, the cultural attaché, which was usually the CIA operative, is a cultural attaché, because they usually went to Yale or Princeton, I think. and so she kind of, and he's entertaining. I mean, he's smart, and he's American, and he's, you know, tolerant of her and understands her situation better than probably most of the people she's dealing with every day.
Yeah.
So why not just sort of float along, and she kind of also needs his protection as well. She needs to make sure that she knows what's going on with the American embassy, because there's still, as far as she knows, a warrant out for her arrest, and she doesn't want to be extradited.
Right. Yeah, their little game is very interesting. I mean, that's sort of classic Graham Greene kind of story.
Well, actually, I went back and reread Greene before I got into this book very deeply, because he does something that nobody else does as well in fiction, and I wanted to know how to do it, because I really wanted to do it as well, if possible, or certainly as well as I could. And that is that he tells a personal story of an individual, a single person, in a historical and social and geographic context that is extremely exotic and probably not known to the reader, whether it's Vietnam or Havana or Haiti or West Africa itself, Sierra Leone, which he's written about. And you read those novels, and you're constantly aware, and you identify with the crisis, that moral or philosophical or religious or whatever, the crisis that the main character is going through. At the same time, you're aware of the degree to which that crisis is both caused by and has larger implications in the political and social world of this rather exotic place. And so he knows what the foreground and how much of it, and what the background and how much of it, in the most balanced way of any writer I've ever read, more than Conrad, more than any contemporary writer, certainly. And so I was really studying how he did that, because I wanted to do that with Iberia and with Hannah. I wanted Hannah's story to be obviously central all the time. And I didn't want it to be a travelogue or a history book or a journalistic or political book. That's just the context. And that's what gives meaning in many ways to her own dilemmas and dramas and conflicts and so forth and quests. But it was important at the same time for me to make it known to the reader, so that when you read the book, you know something about the history of Liberia, and you know something about the history of the underground and weatherman and radical politics in the 60s and 70s. I must say one thing. I just did an interview yesterday in Calgary, the day before, actually, in Calgary. And it was a terrific format. They had three young people who had read the book, young men, say their early mid-20s, interviewing me on the radio, and they weren't journalists. They were just good, serious, intense, bright readers. And a young woman there who was maybe 22, 24 years old, she said, "I have one real question, Mr. Banks. Weatherman. Now, did you make that up, or is it real?" And I suddenly said, "Oh boy, have I gotten old? Did time go by fast?" And because I realized, for her, she's talking about something in the distant past.
That's and right, proportions born.
Yeah. Way back there.
it's a hard thing to think by writing about the 60s and 70s, writing an historical novel.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
That's wonderful. Well, that's really great to hear you talk about Graham Greene in that way, because I was very struck by that and by those echoes. And that's the way it really works. I mean, that's what draws you in, and that Hannah has she's grappling with so many things, including this, really overarching ecological awakening, which, really impressed me. I think that's an incredible, important perspective that people.
Yeah, and it's political. I mean,
it's strongly
on her part.
Political.
Yeah, and when she ends up later years running this farm up in upstate New York, and hires only women and so forth, and has got this thing going. She describes how they raise and kill their chickens as a political act.
Yes.
We do it this way because it's political. Damn it! And so she's still pushing that. That prow, that political prow out there into the world, following it that way, I think.
Yeah, no, it's really important. I mean, it's, sort of addresses this idea that what you do matters, what you eat matters, how you treat animals matters in terms of, just life.
Right.
The larger picture.
Yeah, right. I hope it's true.
Yes, right. It's a good theory anyway.
But it's also a shrinking kind of ambition, too, a shrunken form of the ambition she had as a young woman.
That's right.
And I think that's true for an awful lot of the people who were in, in the movement in those years, is that later years now, in their 60s, many of them are politically active, but they're active in a very local way.
Right.
They're organizing daycare centers or something like that, or they're teaching in a university, teaching political science from their angle on it, or they're writing, or they're running organic farms in Vermont or someplace like that.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
Or like Abby Hoffman was up there working as a ecologist in the green, as a green in the St. Lawrence Valley before he was revealed to be Abby Hoffman. But it's that local political action has replaced the large picture, the ideologically driven neo-Marxist anti-imperial vision that so it is a humbling, I think, and
Especially now.
Especially now. And now, I mean, as she points out, as she gets to the end of the novel, and we begin to realize that, wait a minute, this is being narrated from a point right after 9/11.
Exactly.
And so she's looking at all this through that prism. She realizes gradually that her story couldn't happen in this post 9/11 world, for various reasons, but the main one being that no way could a person coming up her age, as a young person, feel confident that they could go out and by sacrificing their life and their career and their connections to the bourgeois world, could change the world. I mean, that sense of being so far away from power is pervasive, I think, in among the young today. Beyond that, I mean, the security apparatus has changed to such a degree, and the technology of security has changed to such a degree that nobody could get away with the stuff that she got away with, and that all of us got away with, in terms of, you can't falsify a CV today,
That's right.
You get zapped, well, let alone travel around on false passports and identity cards.
It is a tremendous change. And we saw it, too, when months leading up to the war in Iraq, that there were anti-war protests, and they were completely ignored.
Absolutely,
Millions
and millions of people hit the streets, around the world, and yet it was just treated as if it was just a party, something we don't have to take too seriously in any way, except for crowd control.
Exactly.
That was the only thing to worry about. And, the distance from power now that I think people accurately perceive themselves to be in is so much greater than it was prior to this era, And it's only going to get worse, faster and faster. Yeah. I feel like I'm on a Titanic, and the captain's got the, full speed ahead, and I just caught a sight of the iceberg and the darkness looming. It really feels, it really feels scary.
It really does. Yeah. Now, how does that, as a writer, how does that make you feel about writing, feel about books?
Well, what I do as a novelist isn't determined by any desire to be politically active. I mean, I'm politically active in other ways. As a nonfiction writer, I write politically and so forth, and I hope that has some effect politically, socially, and as a citizen, I'm engaged politically. But as a novelist, I'm really not. I know that everything I write has a political dimension to it, inescapably, because it reflects my sympathies, passions, ideals, ambitions, and information about the world, and so it's going to reflect that. It's going to have a political edge or dimension, I should say, to it. It's inescapable. But I don't write out of that purpose, and I don't write out of any ideology or any political positioning. As a novelist, I don't. So it doesn't going to affect me as a novelist. It will affect me. It does affect me as a writer of nonfiction and as a citizen. Because, for instance, there are many things that I can have written and in the United States cannot get published in the United States unless I publish it marginally and in a sense, preach to the choir. I can't get... but I can in Europe. I can publish in Le Monde. I can publish in Der Spiegel. I can publish in The Guardian and The Observer in England and so on. With ease, work that I know I could not, essays and reflections that I know I couldn't publish
that
here.
You could
not in the mass media,
not
no.
In the mainstream.
No, not in the mainstream.
Well, that's an alarming thing.
Yeah,
to hear.
But it's true for, Francine Perose has told me the same story. I've heard it from any number of writers. Terry Tempest Williams have the same situation. You can go up to a certain point, but you can't cross that line without there being right next to you the alternative point of view.
Yes.
You get the two talking heads, essentially. The balanced point of view, as they say, which means neither one counts.
Right, exactly. It's a negation.
And PBS does the same kind of censoring without thinking that they're censoring anybody. NPR does the same kind
absolutely.
Of censoring without thinking that they're censoring because they're giving a balanced point of view. But in fact, what you're doing is creating a context in which neither point of view has to be taken seriously.
That's right, and they're very deliberately undermining the most articulate thinkers.
Right.
Yes.
I mean, I had a long piece that I wrote for as an account of a trip that I took. Really, it was like there were eight writers. I was the only American, but there was, it was an international group of writers that I led to the West Bank. It was, you know, two Nobel Prize winning writers in the group. The Chinese poet Bei Dao was Wole Soyanka, and Jose Saramago, and Brayton Back. And, you know, it was a distinguished group of writers, and we each had agreed beforehand that we would write an account of our journey. And we were in Ramallah, and we were in Gaza, and so forth. And we did. Each of us, and published it in our countries, Consolo in Italy, and so on. So I wrote my account, and it was too long for the New York Times op-ed page. The LA Times wanted me to take out all the political stuff, so it would be sort of a celebrity piece about celebrity writers traveling together. And so finally I published it in The Nation,
yes,
which was fine. I'm happy to publish in The Nation, but it is preaching to the choir.
That's right. That's an incredibly, it's part of the polarization of our culture. All the books that came out about the war in Iraq and about the Bush administration, I would look at them and say to myself, well, no one's going to read these except people that are already concerned and watching this.
Right.
You know, to me, Seymour Hersh is a hero.
Mm-hmm.
To, you know, much of the country, he's no one.
No, I know. Right.
So that's a very, you know, sort of distressing thing to realize. And, you know, if you believe that art sort of crosses boundaries and brings people together, but if it's not available to people, then that won't work either.
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
Very challenging time.
It is. In my lifetime, this is the most challenging is the nicest way to put it I could think of, but it is the most depressing time, too. And I feel most alienated. I've never felt this alienated from my homeland, really. As much outside the fence as I feel today, this morning, November 3rd, and I feel boy, am I outside the fence? I might as well look at real estate prices in Canada.
Oh yeah,
you know, because. It's this country has changed in a way that really saddens and terrifies me in the last 25 years, really going back to the Reagan years, and with at an accelerated rate in the last four, and I fear now at an even greater rate over the next four, to the point where I don't see how it can be brought back to the kind of country it was in its own lame-ass way, you know, in the 70s and 80s, without, not in, in another generation, really, or more.
Yes. Very sobering.
Yeah.
Very sobering times. Yeah. But I'm very grateful that you write what you do write, and that your books are available to people that are curious. I mean, I think partly what we're seeing is lack of curiosity, and people just don't want to know things. And that...
Well, they've been made very comfortable, in a sense, drugged by the media and by the entertainment industry and its hand-in-glove relationship to government and corporate powers. It's who wants to be made uncomfortable when you're comfortable and so on. And,
Well, we're at the end of our hour, and I don't know that it's discomfort. I think it's just being alive and living that examined life.
I agree
that
with you.
So rewarding and important. We'll close our hour by saying to those of you out there, take heart. Thank you for listening to Open Books. We've had the very great pleasure of speaking with Russell Banks, author of Cloud Splitter, Affliction, The Sweet Hereafter, film adaptations of other books, Continental Drift and The Book of Jamaica are in the works.
Yeah, The Rule of the Bone.
The Rule of the Bone, that's very exciting. Russell Banks' newest novel is The Darling. Open Books is funded in part by a grant from the Illinois Arts Council, a state agency. See, some positive things go on. We're very grateful for that. Produced by Donna Seaman and Craig Coyes, Open Books is a public affairs program of Loyola University, Chicago. Thanks so much, Mr. Banks.
Well, thank you, Donna.